Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And it's Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. And on Fridays, we take a break from apologetics and theology to talk about whatever interesting topic I may have stumbled upon or have reached into the recesses of my mind to share with you all. So today, what I want to talk about are the heroes in the germ wars. So those unsung heroes, men and women, who have worked hard, put their human ingenuity to the test, were exemplars of compassion and care that changed modern medicine to help tackle the germs, the bacteria, and the viruses that have caused untold amounts of misery and death for human beings that they were able to stop through their scientific know-how and investigation. So that was interesting because I originally was going to talk about an issue related to MAPS last week that dealt with mapping disease outbreaks. But I thought, you know what? This should just be its own episode right there. So I moved it from MAPS last week, which was a fun episode to talk about. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did not get a chance to hear that episode, go back to the archives for last Free for All Friday, The Weird World of MAPS, and all the other episodes at the Council of Trent. Also, consider becoming a subscriber, trenthornpodcast.com. You make the podcast possible. You get access to all of our bonus content. You get the ability to submit questions to me for future episodes, to vote on the direction the podcast takes, all that and more at trenthornpodcast.com. And if you go back and watch old episodes and you like them, consider leaving a review at iTunes or Google Play. That's always a big help to us. The second reason I wanted to talk about the heroes in the germ wars is that everybody seems to be sick. Are you sick? Are people around you sick? I guess it's just that time of year. Even here in beautiful, sunny California, because usually it's winter, right? When everyone's cooped up inside and it's snowing and they get their little germy hands on everything and everybody seems to end up getting sick because of that. You know, it's always around like winter. But here in California, this is flu season for us. It's cold season for us, even though, you know, it's not that much of a difference. We're still going outside a lot in January. It was a beautiful 74 degrees the other day. I went and took the kids to the park, and oh, it's glorious. I will pay whatever absurd taxes they demand that I pay so I can still enjoy that sunshine. But my poor little family, my wifey, she's sickies. She's like, I don't feel well. Can you give me a hug? I'm like, no way, sickies. No, I gave in because I love her. And my little guy, little Matthew, he's a little sickies. He's like, Daddy, you know what I want for my birthday? Like, what do you want? I want to be able to breathe through my nose. So, poor little guys. I, thankfully, thank you, Lord, have been spared of this. And I certainly do appreciate that because when men get sick, it is scientifically proven that it can be fatal. Colds affect men different than women. And I will point you to this comedy video at the YouTube channel Atomic Wedgie. It's called Man Cold. It's like a 10-year-old video, but it's awesome. It's got one of the guys from, I think it's got one of the actors from Shaun of the Dead in it. It's a British comedy series. And the guy's on the couch and he's got his cold and his wife is there trying to appease him. And I'll let the rest play out for you.
You should have said something. I'd have come down and made you some soup.
I called for you. I said, Laura. Laura. You didn't come. So I dialed 999.
What?
Where is he? Quickly, love. Okay, son. Everything's going to be fine.
I'm going to die.
Not if we can help it.
My head's so burning.
How did this happen?
Oh, he caught the cold off me.
Just don't think, do you?
I'm a bit confused. Hasn't he just got a cold?
For God's sake, woman, he's a man. He's got a man cold. Do not, under any circumstances, move from this bed, okay? You, take this bell. When he rings it, I want you to come to him and rub his head and say, poor little bunny.
Poor little bunny.
Okay, that's good. Let's go. I've got a man in Cantor Avenue with a hurty knee.
Sorry, what about me?
What?
Well, I've got a cold too.
Have you not heard of Lemsit?
Laura, I want some soup and I want to watch CBeebies.
So, Laura, see, that's just me when I'm sick. Laura, I called for you and you didn't answer. Laura. They go, you don't understand. It's not just a cold, it's a man cold. Serious thing. Rub his head and say, you poor little bunny. So, of course, we joke about all that, but diseases and germs have been something that's afflicted humanity for a very long time. Yet only recently did we discover that it was germs that was behind this. If you recall back to an episode, Free for All Friday, I did, it was like 6 months ago. I did one on the Black Death during the 14th century when the bubonic plague spread throughout England. The prevailing theory at the time was not that it was, now we know it was bacterium in fleas. It was Yersties. It was the bacterium carried, in particular, fleas carried on rodents. That is what transmitted the Yersties pestis. It's rattled away back there somewhere, but you know what I'm talking about. The prevailing theory at the time was that it was bad air. That's what was causing people to become sick. This is called the miasma theory. And it goes back a long time. In the first century before Christ, a Roman writer, Vitruvius, this is what he talks about, miasma. I think it was called nebula in Latin. And he said that for when the morning breezes blow toward the town at sunrise, if they bring with them mist from marshes and mingled with the mist, the poisonous breath of creatures of the marshes to be wafted into the bodies of the inhabitants, they will make the site unhealthy. So it was believed that if a town got sick, it's because the air had become poisoned or bad. It was miasma. There was poisonous or bad air that had come from swamplands or other places. Poisonous creatures breathe in the air, and that contaminates the air, and then it gets into people's lungs, and it makes them sick. So during the Black Death, you recall I talked about this in the episode, if you look up Black Death plague masks, that doctors would wear these really weird masks. You can get them at costume shops now. They're hilarious to wear. You had these goggles, and you had these long beaks that they would wear. It looked like little bird beaks, like big, long, curved bird beaks. It's a creepy thing. And the inside of the beaks were filled with flowers, freshly scented flowers. And the idea was that the fresh scents would combat the miasma, that that a bad smell had disease and sickness in it, and so you could prevent the spread of the plague by having good scented flowers inside of this beak mask that you would wear. Now, it's interesting that this is not that far off of a theory, because many pathogens, you think about influenza, for example, many pathogens are airborne. And so if you are not within airborne contact of someone who is sick, you won't get sick. And the doctors who wore the plague masks, that may have helped to cut down on them getting sick, because they also wore these long coats as well. And so the coats would help keep the fleas off. And then when they're attending to people, there could have been other secondary illnesses. They didn't get like pneumonia or things like that because they had these masks on. So for the longest time, it was thought all the way up into the middle of the 19th century, the miasma theory of illness, that it was the bad air itself is what made people sick. And as I said, that's not that bad of a guess, because when you look at someone who is sick, they usually smell bad. And a corpse is going to smell bad. And trash or sewage that makes you sick does tend to smell bad. The problem here, of course, is confusing that which corresponds with something, that which correlates with it, versus it's a correlation versus causation fallacy. Just because bad air oftentimes accompanies sickness, you know, foul smelling, malodorous air, just because it correlates with it, of course, doesn't mean that the bad air is what's causing it. You are confusing a symptom or an effect with the primary cause itself. And so then people were unable to see that it was not the bad air, it was little germs, little bugs, bacteria, viruses, in some cases, protists or fungi, that were causing these illnesses. But that started to change in the midst of the 19th century. Sometimes some indirectly, other times directly. One thing that indirectly changed this was the work of Florence Nightingale. You probably heard of Florence Nightingale, the nurse. Maybe you've heard of the Nightingale effect. So Florence Nightingale is a very famous nurse from England, lived from 1820 to 1910. And she rose to prominence during the Crimean War. She was sent with a bunch of other nurses to Crimea, which is kind of on the border around the Black Sea, Turkey, Russia type area. She was sent to Crimea to tend to the people there, the soldiers who were sick. And honestly, the soldiers there were dying more in the hospitals than they were on the battlefields. This is one report. Says after hearing article says after hearing disheartening reports of the mistreatment of wounded soldiers and outbreaks of cholera and malaria, Nightingale and 38 nurses traveled to the Ottoman Empire. 6 months after Nightingale arrived, death rates continued to rise. Florence, like most others during this period, believed in the miasma theory, the idea that diseases like cholera and typhoid were transmitted through foul air. Well, we know that cholera is transmitted through the water. We'll get to that shortly. However, Florence remained firm in this belief until her death, but she did believe that poor hygiene was responsible for many deaths. And so she made it her task to make the hospital sanitary. So she improved ventilation. She had the sewage flushed out. She wanted it to smell nice, look nice, be bright, be airy. And so even though Nightingale was wrong about the cause of disease, it actually is the germs, it's not the bad air itself. She was right that if you make an environment that's well ventilated, that's bright, that doesn't have waste nearby. Nightingale also encouraged the nurses to wash their hands before interacting with wounded soldiers, not to get rid of germs, but just to get rid of filth or dirt. The idea was that cleanliness, so that things were fresh smelling, would make people be healthier. Now, she missed the germs, but she got it in an indirect way, because when you make things cleaner, you know, there's going to be less germs, less likely for people to become ill. And so actually studies have shown that rooms, and so my wife's always like, Trent, stop closing the curtains. I'm such a man. I always turn the house into like a cave. Do you know anyone like that in your life? They want to live in a cave. They don't want the sunlight, like a vampire. I'm like, you know, shut those curtains. But studies have shown that rooms where sunlight is able to penetrate the room have less bacteria in it than rooms where the curtains are closed. And that's because sunlight has ultraviolet radiation in it, which can kill some bacteria. Now, it's not a super great disinfectant, but it does cut down on some bacteria, and that's always helpful. So Nightingale's work there was helpful in improving conditions, but it was still plagued, pun intended, by the belief that it was the bad air itself and not the germs that had to be isolated. Oh, by the way, the Nightingale effect, from what I can see from my research, is not, it's more of a trope in literature and film. The idea that patients will fall in love with their nurses, than the idea that, you know, there's not, I don't think it's as well documented as a scientific phenomenon. It's more of a trope you see in literature and film about budding relationships between patients and nurses. But if you're a nurse, if you're a doctor, maybe you've seen the Nightingale effect in full form, or you've read up on this, feel free to leave a comment at trenthornpodcast.com. Love to hear more about that. However, I could see why people would like Nightingale. There are people who certainly took a fancy to her, because she also revolutionized not just keeping things clean, but for nurses to have particular attention and care to their patients. One article describes her as a ministering angel. It says, this was written back in the late 19th century, says of Nightingale, "She is a ministering angel without any exaggeration in these hospitals. As her slender form glides quietly along each corridor, every poor fellow's face softens with gratitude at the sight of her. When all the medical officers have retired from the night and silence and darkness have settled down upon those miles of prostrate sick, she may be observed alone with a little lamp in her hand, making her solitary rounds." So that is Florence Nightingale. She came to be known as the Lady of the Lamp, that she revolutionized patient care, that, you know, the doctors and everyone like, okay, in the night I'm going to bed. And so you've got these sick people in the middle of the night. And if you've ever been sick, sometimes the night is the worst time to be sick. So when your symptoms flare up, you can't sleep, you're miserable. And so she incorporated the practice of making nightly rounds with the soldiers and with those who were infirm to be able to care for them in the middle of the night. And nurses still have similar rounds to this very day. All right, let's move on to our next hero, though, who helped to move us beyond the miasma theory to the germ theory of disease, and that is John Snow. Born 1813, died in 1858, he was an English physician and a leader in the development of anesthesia and medical hygiene. He became most famous for his work in tracing the cholera outbreak in Soho, London in 1854. This is also called the Broad Street cholera outbreak. And so what happened was that cholera was breaking out all over London. It's a very terrible disease you don't want to get only on the Oregon Trail. And it's spread by contaminated fecal matter in water. But if you think that everything's spread by the air, it can be hard to diagnose it. So this article says that by talking to local residents with the help of Reverend Henry Whitehead, Snow identified the source of the outbreak as the public water pump on Broad Street. So then he did an analysis, but mostly what he did is he made a map tracking the cholera outbreak in order to find out what was happening. And so this is a letter to the editor of Medical Times, Snow talking about what he did. So he says, "On proceeding to the spot, I found that nearly all the deaths had taken place within a short distance of the Broad Street pump. There were only 10 deaths in houses situated decidedly nearer to another street pump. In five of these cases, the families of the deceased persons informed me that they always went to the pump in Broad Street, as they preferred the water to that of the pumps which were nearer. In three other cases, the deceased were children who went to school near the pump in Broad Street. With regard to the deaths occurring in the locality belonging to the pump, there were 61 instances in which I was informed that the deceased persons used to drink the pump water from Broad Street either constantly or occasionally." So what he did was he made a map, and he pioneered principles in epidemiology, which is the study of the spread of disease. And so you're trying to understand, okay, how does the disease spread? You can't just find out who has the disease. You have to find out who has the disease, what they have in common, and also who doesn't have the disease and what they have in common as well. So you could have people who are living in close proximity to one another on Broad Street. One has cholera, the other doesn't, the other family doesn't. Why not? If it was miasma, if it was contaminated air, you would think that it would affect people evenly throughout the area. But the mapping of the disease showed that it was not an airborne illness. It was something connected to the water that people came to find. And then they did an investigation on Broad Street, and you can still see a monument of it, the memorial to this day. It says that researchers later discovered that the Broad Street well had been dug only 3 feet from an old cesspit, which had begun to leak fecal bacteria. The cloth nappy, or diaper, of a baby who had contracted cholera from another source had been washed into this cesspit. Its opening was originally under a nearby house, which had been rebuilt further away after a fire. The city had widened the street and the cesspit was lost. It was common at the time to have a cesspit, you know, like a cesspool, you saw your sewage collected under your house, basically, under most homes. Most families tried to have their raw sewage collected and dumped in the Thames to prevent their cesspit from filling faster than the sewage could decompose into the soil. The problem was that after the cholera epidemic had subsided, government officials replaced the Broad Street pump handle. They went and they took the handle off the pump, and then immediately the outbreak ceased when people could no longer access water from that pump. They had responded only to the urgent threat posed to the population, and afterward they rejected Snow's theory. To accept his proposal would have meant indirectly accepting the fecal-oral route of disease transmission, which was too unpleasant for most of the public to contemplate because, well, if you lived in 19th century England, which is crazy that in ancient Rome they actually had better toilet facilities and ability to get rid of waste in some cases than what you find in like Victorian England, people realize they lived in a literal crap hole. And then to realize that's what's causing disease, wouldn't be able to stomach it. But then eventually the research won out and important steps were made in hygiene, and we live in the modern world we have today. But there's parts of the developing world that still deal with these kinds of outbreaks because they don't have effective ways to get rid of sewage and things like that. So if you want to thank the reason why you don't have to deal with cholera right now, Jon Snow, not the guy from, is it Game of Thrones? I never watched Game of Thrones, but I think there's a Jon Snow in Game of Thrones. Not him, the 19th century British physician. Our next hero is Mr. Robert Koch, born 1843, died in 1910. So all these people lived around the same time, and their discoveries were kind of contemporaneous with each other. Koch was a German physician and microbiologist. As one of the main founders of modern bacteriology, he identified the causative agents of tuberculosis, cholera, and anthrax, and gave experimental support for the concept of infectious disease, which included experiments on humans and other animals. One of the things that he made that's been very helpful to medicine and epidemiology today is the creation of Koch's postulates, a series of 4 generalized principles linking specific microorganisms to specific diseases that remain today the gold standard in medical microbiology. So Koch's postulates, there are 4 principles. They're not rigid. They don't apply to every disease. And sometimes people apply them too rigidly. They miss the point of the postulates. But it's a good standard to figure out how do you determine if a certain bacteria or microorganism, it could be any kind of microorganism, it could be a bacteria, a virus, could be fungi, could be a protist, just a single-celled organism. And you can get sick if you get Giardia? You get really sick illness if you drink from mountain streams that are contaminated with protists, single-celled organisms. So Koch's postulates are these 4 principles. To show that a microorganism causes a disease, this causal relationship. One, the microorganism must be found in abundance in all organisms suffering from the disease, but should not be found in healthy organisms. So if bacteria A causes Trenthorn disease, you'll find bacteria A in the people with Trenthorn disease, and you won't find bacteria A in the healthy people. If you see it in both people, well, then you've got a problem. It's probably not the cause. It's not necessarily. Two, the microorganism must be isolated from a diseased organism and grown in a pure culture. You should be able to take the pathogen and be able to grow it in a pure culture to show that this pathogen can reproduce itself. Three, the cultured microorganism should cause disease when introduced into a healthy organism. So if you can take bacteria A out of someone who has Trenthorn madness, could be caused by excessive listening to the Council of Trent podcast. So if you take away the podcast and you have someone else listen to the podcast and they get Trenthorn madness, then it's the Council of Trent podcast that is causing it. But if there are healthy people listening to Trenthorn podcast and unhealthy people listening to it and there are people without the madness who listen to the podcast you hear, the podcast is probably not causing this madness or hysteria in them. So let's review. For Koch's postulates, the organism's got to be found in abundance in those with the disease, but you don't find it in healthy organisms. You got to be able to isolate it and grow it in a pure culture dish. When you take that cultured organism, if you put it into a healthy organism or a healthy animal and it gets sick, that's another sign. And finally, the microorganism must be re-isolated from the inoculated diseased experimental host and identified as being identical to the original agent. So if you can introduce the cultured agent, the animal dies or gets sick, you take it back out, you compare it to the original, it's the same bacteria, bada boom, bada bing, you've gone through Koch's postulates, you can show that this microorganism, bacteria, virus, whatever, it is the thing that is causing this particular kind of illness. And so that's helpful. You need that in order to develop proper treatments, proper antibiotics, proper ways to immunize people. And so Koch helped to develop that. And what's interesting is that some people try to use this for pseudoscience. So there are some people, you're going to say, well, why are Koch's postulates, why is this important? Well, there are people who promote a pseudoscience called HIV/AIDS denialism. Maybe you haven't heard of it. I only hear of it because I watch Law & Order SVU. And Law & Order SVU, if you watch it, it's been going on, for like 20 seasons now? I mean, Ice-T, the guy who once did Cop Killer, who was with NWA, he's now like the longest running police officer in television history. Oh, I get it. So you're telling me that these guys like to watch little girls in pigtails and get off on that? Yeah, Ice-T, they're pedophiles. You should know that. John Mulaney does a wonderful, look up John Mulaney Law & Order SVU on YouTube. Great comedian, does a good bit on that. But the thing with Law & Order SVU, and Mulaney points this out, is that it's kind of get more and more bizarre. So Law & Order SVU, if you never watched it, Law & Order Special Victims Unit. So Law & Order has been around forever, and it deals with all different kinds of crimes. Law & Order SVU is always something that has to do with like children or rape or sexual crime or child abuse. So it's already a narrow kind of show. And the series has to keep like coming up with weird, weird stuff, like getting into weird subcultures, weird fetishes, to have to keep upping the ante because they're going through so many seasons. And I remember one episode that the big twist, it starts out with a crime, but the big twist was that it was a doctor causing people who have HIV or AIDS to get worse because he's promoting HIV/AIDS denialism, saying that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, it's actually caused by something else. They say, you know, they make these claims like it's just a passenger virus, it's harmless, that AIDS is caused by malnutrition or poor sanitation, and so you shouldn't take HIV retroviral drugs because they don't work. And I'm like, man, is this a real thing? And then I go on the internet, and it turns out it is a real thing. And it's really bad in Africa. There's a lot of AIDS conspiracies in Africa, including the former president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki. He was promoting AIDS denialism for a while. So here's a clip from a public service broadcast talking about that.
Tsepo Nkwatu was 11 years old when his mother died of AIDS-related illness. She was never given ARVs and died in the same year that then President Thabo Mbeki uttered these words.
Does HIV cause AIDS? Does one virus cause a syndrome? A virus cannot cause a syndrome.
Tsepo would find out after his mother's death that he'd been born with HIV. He's now an outspoken HIV activist and is open about his status.
I don't care. You know, if my friends decide to back off, let them back off. Friends, you know, I can make another friend and like tomorrow, the following day, that friend will actually accept my status.
Mbeki sparked controversy this week when he repeated his stance that a virus, which is what HIV is, cannot cause a syndrome, which is how AIDS is identified.
But here's the thing, according to an article in New Scientist magazine, so AIDS denialists will make all these arguments and they'll say that HIV doesn't meet Koch's postulates. But according to New Scientist magazine, it goes on to say it is debatable how appropriate it is to focus on a set of principles devised for bacterial infections in a century when viruses had not been discovered. HIV does, however, meet Koch's postulates as long as they are not applied in a ridiculously stringent way. And this was proven, actually, in a series of tragic accidents, including one where multiple scientific technicians with no other known risk factors were exposed to concentrated HIV in a laboratory accident and transmission by a dentist to patients, the majority of whom had no other known risk factor or source of exposure except the same dentist in common. So it does meet that. And I'll have to do another free-for-all Friday on pseudoscience and the harm it causes people. Let's continue. The other, probably the most famous person in the 19th century in the fight against germs, and that would be Louis Pasteur. So Louis Pasteur was a scientist who helped to disprove the theories of spontaneous generation. And he was actually criticized a lot during this time by the scientists who defended it, saying that air could spontaneously create disease or germs or things like that that caused people to be sick. It was believed that bad air could just spontaneously create maggots and other negative things that would cause people to have poor health. And so Pasteur performed a series of experiments to disprove that. What he did was he placed boiled liquid in a flask and let hot air enter the flask. Then he closed the flask and no microorganisms grew in it. Pasteur also used swan neck flasks. So these are glass tubes that have a bowl to collect liquid, and they have a curve in it. And so air enters the flask by a long curving tube that made dust particles stick to it. Nothing grew in the broths, where normally if a organism gets into the broth, it will reproduce. It's kind of one of the first laboratory cultures. Nothing grew in the broths unless the flasks were tilted, making the liquid touch the contaminated walls of the neck. This showed that the living organisms that grew in such broths came from outside on dust rather than spontaneously generating within the liquid or from the action of pure air. And through these experiments, Pasteur won the Alembert Prize in 1862. And he said, "Never will the doctrine of spontaneous generation recover from the mortal blow of this simple experiment. There is no known circumstance in which it could be confirmed that microscopic beings came into the world without germs, without parents similar to themselves." And finally, to wrap all of this up, I should have gotten more. I made it through the 19th century. Just remember, Alexander Fleming made penicillin in 1928, and he got it on bread that left out accidentally and made a fungus. I'll save that. Maybe for 20th century health discoveries. We'll put that there. So for now, Fleming, you'll get your own episode later. But when we're looking at the 19th century, Pasteur, Koch, John Snow, and also the work of Florence Nightingale, heroes in the germ wars at that time. Let me leave you with this question. Hand sanitizer or soap? Which is better for you? According to the CDC recommends washing hands with soap and water whenever possible because hand washing reduces the amounts of all types of germs and chemicals on hands. But if soap and water are not available, using a hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol can help you avoid getting sick and spreading germs to other people. You need soap because soap has lipids that allows it to bond to things and get them off of your skin. Otherwise, the water just rushes over them. It doesn't do anything. So soap and water, it's more effective at removing things like Cryptosporidium, norovirus, and Clostridium difficile. You know, norovirus, that's the stuff you get on like cruise ships. It will really make your cruise not a lot of fun. When I went on the Catholic Answers cruise, I was amazed actually the attendants, the staff on the cruise ship, the crew, they would wipe down every surface on the ship. And because if you get an outbreak on a ship, oh, good luck. Wait to see. And that has happened. It happened on Carnival Cruise Lines not too long ago. But the ones we went on, Holland America, good stuff. And they were wiping down everything. And they had hand sanitizer everywhere. But the best thing you can do is to wash your hands and especially get under your fingernails and just get on your fingertips under soap and water. That's the best thing you can do. And I'm always trying to wash my hands. But even I can't do that. So when I travel all the time for work. So what I do is I take antibacterial wipes. I wipe down my plane seat before I eat. I wash my hands because I'm also at events. I shake people's hands at book signing events. And then before I go eat afterwards, I make sure to wash my hands. Or if I can't wash my hands, I put a nice heaping helping of hand sanitizer. I rub it and then I let it air dry. You don't want the hand sanitizer to fall off or get wiped off. You got to wipe it together. So soap is more effective than hand sanitizer, except in one case, toddlers. Except in the case of toddlers. Here's why. A recent study looked at what was more effective in keeping, this was published in an article at Cleveland Clinic, .org, 2018. A recent study looked at what was more effective in keeping little ones free of respiratory infections, soap and water, or alcohol-based hand sanitizers. The study looked at 911 children between the ages of 0 and 3 enrolled in daycare facilities. There's a good place to have a little germ factory right there. They divided the children into three groups. One group did their normal hand cleaning routine. One group was instructed on how to properly wash with liquid hand soap. And the third group used liquid hand sanitizers. Researchers found that over an 8-month period, the group of children that used the hand sanitizers had 23% fewer respiratory infections. Dr. Frank Esper, from the pediatric infectious disease expert at Cleveland Children's Hospital, says, "It's not necessarily that soap and water is less effective, but rather that very young children are not as good at washing their hands." And so that totally makes sense. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. Now, fortunately, Matt can make it up in the sink and he climbs up there, he washes his hands and he gets the soap in there and does it. But I could not imagine Thomas at 2 years old just like going and washing his hands or even trying getting the soap under the fingernails, rubbing it together, getting it under the water. If anything, try taking your kids to Disneyland and they go to the we go to the bathroom. I take them to the bathroom at Disneyland and we go into the bathroom and I say, all right, we're going to play a game. The game is called, because I remember once, Laura, here's our trick with Disney. See, I managed to get Disney into the podcast. What we do around lunchtime is I send Laura out of the park to go to McDonald's to get nuggets and burgers, far better than the food you'll usually find there. And while she's gone, I watch the kiddos. We go on the Jungle Cruise or something. But then I remember the last time we were there, Matthew's like, I have to go to the bathroom right now. And so we head into the bathroom and I got Thomas and I got Matt and we're going into the stall. And any parent who takes their kids to the bathroom appreciates this. It's like, okay, here's what we're going to do, everybody. We're going to play a game. It's called Don't Touch Anything Here. And I was like, Thomas, here's how you play the game. Put your hands together like you're praying. I put hands together like pray, Dad. I'm like, yes, that's right. It lasts for about 3 seconds and then he touches the toilet. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then you go and you try to wash their hands in the sink. And they're like touching the edges of the sink. And you're like, no, just get it under the water. So I could see it with little kids trying to get them to wash their hands in a sink. They'll probably just touch the parts of the sink to get dirtier. You almost just want to have them put their hands out to a dispenser, get a ton of sanitizer and rub their hands. So for you grownups, wash your hands. Little kids, toddlers, sometimes it's just, you know, especially if they're doing it themselves, so hand sanitizer just might be better for their particular age. But tip for you all, at least I feel like this has helped keep me from getting sick. In our car, we keep a pump of hand sanitizer. Whenever the kids get back in the car, they get hand sanitizer on their hands. Then you get home, you get a hand washing. Might be a nice tip for you all as well to make it through cold season, flu season. Stay safe out there. Stay healthy. And I hope you'll be back with me next week for more great episodes of the Council of Trent podcast. Thank you guys so much. I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.